In late 1975, many years ago, I made a pilgrimage to the holy places of Buddhism in India, together with an Indian monk who was a friend of mine. And we went to visit Lumbini, which is the birthplace of the Buddha. And it was on the way back into India, after we had gotten back from Nepal into India, we were waiting by a bus stop and some small godforsaken town. I don't remember the name of it. And while we were standing there waiting for the bus, a kind of ascetic came by going to the shops. And he was crawling on the ground on his arms and legs. When he would reach each stop, he would stop in front of the shop and start barking. And the shopkeeper would throw some food item, and he would go over on his hands and knees, pick it up with his mouth, and chew it and swallow it. And when I saw this, I realized I was seeing a scene that could have been taking place 2,500 years earlier. That this tradition has been kept alive in India, even after the near death of Buddhism itself, but of ascetics who imitate the behavior of animals and think that by doing so they are performing some extraordinary deed of holiness which will get them the blessings of the deities, which will generate some kind of supernormal power and bring them liberation or a heavenly rebirth. I don't recall whether this ascetic that I saw was going naked or whether he had some kind of garments on. I remember it was very cold in northern India. This was in December. And so he might have been wearing some clothing to keep himself warm. But in other respects, he was behaving very much like a dog. Okay, so now we're going to meet with some of his progenitors, early representatives of that particular lineage, in the sutta called the Kukuravattika Sutta. Dog duty ascetic. Okay, so this sutta takes place when the Buddha was living in the Kolian country, where there was a town of the Kolians named Halidavasana. Okay, and now there were two ascetics who came to the Buddha. One of them, by the name of Puna, is called an ox duty ascetic. And the other, named Sainya, was a naked dog duty ascetic. So they come to the Buddha. Puna pays homage to him. That means he bows down to him and sits down to one side. While as the dog duty ascetic, it seems if he actually exchanged greetings and talk with the Buddha, then to that extent he departed from his dog observance. But after he exchanged his greetings with the Buddha, then he sits down at one side and he curls up like a dog. Okay, then Puna, the ox duty ascetic, points to Sainya and tells about his practice. He says that this Sainya is a dog duty ascetic who eats his food when it is thrown to the ground. And for a long time he has taken up in practice this dog duty, this practice of a dog. So what will be his destination? What course will he follow in the future? Then the Buddha is sort of going to build up momentum. He says, enough, alang puna. Do not ask me that. But Puna is insistent. He asks a second time, a third time. And then when the Buddha is asked something three times, after refusing twice, if the questioner persists and asks a third time, then as long as the questioner admits of some answer, then the Buddha has to answer. And so now the Buddha says, since I couldn't stop you from asking your question, I'll have to answer. So he says, now if someone has developed the dog duty fully and uninterruptedly, he develops the dog habit fully and uninterruptedly, he develops the mind of a dog fully and uninterruptedly, he develops dog behavior fully and uninterruptedly. So when he dies, passes away, where is he going to be reborn? Where? As a dog. Does it take a Buddha to answer that question? Okay, but if he has the view that by following this particular mode of behavior, this type of ascetic practice, or what we call a holy life, I shall be reborn as a deity, as a god, then that is wrong view. He's holding a wrong view. And for one who holds wrong view, the Buddha says, there are two destinations, hell or the animal realm. So, Puna, if his dog practice succeeds, it will lead him to the company of dogs. But if it fails because of the wrong view, it will lead him to hell. I have to say, I find this a bit, well, more than a bit, very too strong in the case of somebody who holds the view that, say, a dog ascetic practice is going to lead to heaven. Of course, even if he promulgates a view like that or holds a view, it's not really inflicting a great deal of harm on others. So it seems to me somewhat strong to say that this type of view will lead to hell. But this is in the text. The type of view that would seem more likely to lead to a rebirth in hell would be like the view, some of the views that we've already encountered, that there's no point in doing meritorious deeds, that if one goes around killing people, one doesn't do any evil. If a person goes and gives a lot of money, a lot of help and charity, he doesn't get any merit and won't advance himself spiritually. So it's pointless to practice charity, to practice generosity. That would be the kind of wrong view that I think would lead to hell. But anyway, this is what the text says. So when the Buddha has spoken, then Sainiya, the dog duty ascetic, he's now emotionally upset, and so he bursts out crying. Then the Buddha says to Puna, he says, I couldn't convince you when I said, don't ask me the question. And now Sainiya says that he is not crying because the Buddha has said this about him, but he's crying because he's practiced this dog asceticism for such a long time, and now he realizes that it was all useless. And so now Sainiya, in his turn, asks the same question about his friend, the ox duty ascetic, one who behaves like a cow or an ox. What will be his future? Again, the Buddha refuses to answer. Three times the question is posed. The third time the Buddha answers in the logical way. If somebody has been behaving like an ox for such a long time, chewing grass, well, what do oxes do? All day they just chew grass. They don't play ball, they don't go for, well, they do go for walks just to find another patch of grass, but not to enjoy scenery. What else do oxes do? Pull loads, but probably no peasant is going to take a human being and ask him to pull a heavy wagon. When they feel dirty and sweaty, then they will go for a bath in a pond, a muddy pond. They'll wallow in the mud for some time, come up, and again start chewing the grass. You see that life in the animal realm, even in a fairly safe and secure type of existence, it's not very diversified, not very entertaining. Okay, so if as a human being he carries on in this way for such a long time, then after death, he'll be reborn as an ox, if he doesn't hold any view about it. But again, if he holds the wrong view that by following this practice of an ox, one will be reborn as a deity in heaven, then that is wrong view. And so for one with wrong view, it will lead either to hell or the animal realm. Okay, so then Puna breaks out crying. And then the exchange is the same. Puna explains that he is not crying because of what the Buddha said, because now he realizes that he has taken up this practice of ox-like asceticism for a long time, and it's been completely useless. Maybe he's been wasting, I don't know, 3 years, the text doesn't specify, 3 years, 5 years, maybe even 10 years, just carrying on in this mode. But now Puna has gotten some seed of, we call prasada, of confidence or trust in the Buddha. And so he says that I have confidence that the Blessed One is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I can abandon this ox duty asceticism, and that my friend Sainiya here can abandon that dog duty asceticism. In other words, he has confidence that the Buddha will be able to teach him some wholesome, beneficial Dhamma which will show him the true way to liberation and lead him out of this kind of pitfall that he's been in of undertaking this extreme and futile type of ascetic practice. So now we come to what we call the core of this sutta. The Buddha is going to explain four types of karma. And here is the important phrase. There are these four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. That the Buddha bases this teaching upon, not upon what has come down in the lineage of teachers from the Brahmins, say, not upon speculation, logic, reasoning, but on the basis of abhinya, that is direct or higher knowledge, through realization that takes place, personal realization. He has realized them, he says, I have realized them for myself. Sayang abhinya sachikatva pavedesi. Okay, so first he gives the outline. What are the four in the abstract? Dark karma with dark result. Bright action, bright karma with bright result. Dark and bright action with dark and bright result. And then action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result. Action that leads to the destruction of action. Or it's actually karma, a type of karma that leads to the destruction of karma. A type of action that breaks the chain of karmic causation that holds one in bondage to the round of repeated birth and death. And that will be the type of action that issues, eventuates in liberation. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to elaborate upon this outline. A schedule. And as usual, he begins with the dark side. What is the dark action with dark result? Here, someone generates an afflictive bodily formation, an afflictive verbal formation, an afflictive mental formation. And here, because of the English language, one has to use a different word for the verb. Here I use generates. And then for the noun, formation. But the Pali reads, ida puno ekacho Sabya pajang kaya sankaran abhisan karoti. So the verb and the noun are actually like two forms of the same word. See, the noun here is sankara, and the key part of the verb is sankaroti. Abhi is just an intensifying prefix. Yeah. P, yeah. Different texts, like different traditions. There are two words which sort of float back and forth. And I didn't write it down. Good. Okay. Yeah, well, so let's make it the B. So you might say it's somewhat, but it doesn't sound so good, forms a bodily formation. But that doesn't really get so much meaning across in English. But what this indicates is that one gives rise to or gives way to an volition, an intention, a mental action, an act of volition, which expresses itself through the body as a bodily action. Or sometimes it's a volition, that's a mental activity, which expresses itself through speech as a verbal action, an act of speech. Or sometimes there arises a volition, an intention, which just solidifies in the form of plans, schemes, projects, purposes, wishes, desires, yearnings. And these activities, bodily activities, verbal activities, mental activities, they all spring from this activity of volition, of will, of intention. And once they arise and pass, either expressing themselves outwardly in action or just remaining bottled up inside, they deposit kind of energy. A potent energy within the flowing stream of consciousness. And this accumulation of mental energy, habit energy, volitional energy, this accumulation of energy becomes a tremendous force which at the time of death projects the stream of consciousness into a new realm of being, a new realm of existence, in conformity with, what I call, the intrinsic ethical quality of the volitions themselves. And so, in the first case, we are taking what is called afflictive formations of body, speech, and mind. These will be generally actions that throw suffering out into the world, actions that bring suffering to others. And these will be especially transgressions or violations of the 10 types of unwholesome karma. Which we saw explained in the previous sutta that we discussed. Sutta number 46, the great discourse on ways to undertaking things. And we'll come across again when we take, I think it's sutta number 41. And so when one generates this afflictive bodily formation, killing, stealing, committing sexual misconduct, speaking strong types of false speech, malicious speech, speech that splits friendships, speaking harshly, angrily to others, indulging in gossip, nurturing thoughts of covetousness, of ill will or wrong views, then one appears in an afflictive world. That is, the stream of consciousness will take rebirth in a realm of existence in which the predominant quality of experience is one of pain or suffering. Okay, but first one is reborn in an afflictive world. And when one is reborn in such a world, then afflictive contacts touch one. One is exposed to constant bombardment by sensory data, sensory objects, which are painful, harsh, difficult to endure. And when one is touched or impinged upon by these afflictive contacts, then one feels afflictive feelings, feelings of strong suffering, in this case exclusively painful, hardly any pleasant sensations. As in the case of the beings in hell, this is the extreme case. And I want to sketch this structure out on the board because it's quite interesting in connection with some other aspects of the Buddha's teaching. Does this formula start to resonate or ring any bells? Exactly, exactly. You could see here, sort of call it intimations of dependent origination. Where do these volitional formations originate from? What is the underlying condition for them? Volitional formations depend upon ignorance. If a person didn't have any avidya or ignorance, then they wouldn't create these afflictive formations, volitional formations. Then what is the world in terms of concrete experience? We usually think of the world as being a solid, you know, dwelling place in which by chance we happen to be, to find ourselves. But the world as lived experience is an interplay of consciousness with name and form. This is not to say the world is just a mental creation. But the world of experience is always involves a consciousness of a world, and then with the objective domain of form, and then you might call the conceptual apprehension of form, name. And then it is out of name and form, our interaction with the world of form, and our conceptual way of processing the forms conceptually, that we undergo contacts. And then from contacts arise feelings. So we think, at least some, that, okay, this world of matter is what's real and solid. It's through just the chance interplay of atoms, that molecules are formed somehow through the chance development of certain environmental conditions. The molecules became more and more complex till they were capable of certain vital functions. Life appears. Then through building up of more complex chains of molecules, of living molecules, somehow, bing, out of nowhere, mind or consciousness appears. And that mind or consciousness, it's just a chance byproduct out of this blind shuffling around of material particles. That's the dominant view of what's called materialism, scientific, philosophical materialism. But according to the Buddha's teaching, all of these realms of existence are, in a sense, stages for the unfolding of mind or consciousness. And so this is here, I give like my interpretation, that we have the early manifestation, early formation of this particular physical universe in which we are living, this particular world system, before mind or consciousness appears. So we should understand that it is the accumulated karma of the beings who are due to be reborn in this world system that brings about the solidification of matter in this world system. It's a kind of hidden dynamo of energy behind the visible forms of the world. But at this point in cosmic evolution, there, I speak of visible forms, but there are no beings around to see what's going on. But matter, with following the Big Bang, starts to solidify from that very intense moment of where matter just forms, starts to form. Then gradually, clusters of matter aggregates into clusters. From those clusters, stars begin to be born. The stars form into galaxies. Then eventually, planets appear and life appears. And at time, consciousness appears. But what has been behind the whole process is the accumulated karmic energy from the beings in the previous world system. And that karmic energy is not in a conscious way, but it is fueling or driving cosmic evolution till physical conditions obtain which are capable of supporting conscious evolution, the appearance of conscious beings. Then those beings with the karmic affinity with this particular world system will start appearing in the form of sentient beings. And then once the world takes shape with its different realms of existence, then beings appear in the different realms according to their karmic affinity with those realms, their karmic connections with them. And so consciousness is not just like some chance visitor who's just accidentally stumbled upon the door of entrance into life or the world systems, as philosophical materialism will hold. But consciousness, the consciousness of living beings, is really the constructor or creator of the universe, with all of its different realms of existence. And so it's through our conscious, let us say, our volitional activity directed towards one realm of existence or another that we are reborn in that particular realm. And so in the case of those who generate a lot of afflictive karmic actions, karmic, afflictive karmic formations, their volition, their accumulated batteries of mental activity will lead them to rebirth in the lower realms, into the hell realm. Realms of intense suffering. Not as punishment, there's nobody who's standing above and saying, you go to hell, but there is a universal, impersonal, ethical law underlying the whole process of transformations of consciousness. And it is that ethical law, impersonal, universal, but ever active, inescapable, that determines that these types of actions, the unwholesome, the afflictive actions, will steer a being to rebirth in the lower realms. And so the Buddha says, thus, a being's reappearance or rebirth is due to a being. That is, the reason why any being is reborn in any particular state is because of that very being himself, herself. Whether it be a human being, an animal, a deva or god, a hell being, it is speaking conventionally, not in terms of a permanent individual self, but what we call a living being, a process of conscious becoming. This being, through its activities, its volitions, its deeds, is always in the process of creating its own future destiny. We ourselves, we're through our actions, our choices, our decisions, we are always creating our own future in this beginningless process of rebirths. That's why we have to set ourselves lofty and noble aims and apply ourselves vigorously to the way of action that will lead to the realization of those aims. Okay, so a being's reappearance or rebirth is due to a being. One reappears, or one is reborn, through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, been reborn, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are the heirs of their own actions. When we die, we leave our property, our land, our houses, cars, jewelry, money, to children, husband, wife, whatever. What do we inherit when we go on to the next life? Nothing except our karma. It's the only thing that follows along. Our karma and our mental dispositions. Yeah.
Right?
It's not really.
Yeah, because that would be reincarnation. It's not reincarnation.
Yeah. It's rebirth. Yeah, yeah. So, speaking sort of in a conventional level, we say it's ours, in that the karma that determines, again in quotation marks, my mode of rebirth in my next life, not the actions that Gao Ming performs or that Ken performs or you perform. But it's the actions that, conventionally speaking, I, this person, has performed in this life. Okay, so then we now come to bright action with bright result. Okay, here somebody generates a unafflictive bodily formation, or unafflictive formations of body, speech, mind. Unafflictive bodily formations and so on. These will be actions that conform to the 10 pathways of wholesome karma, but that don't go beyond them. We'll see what's meant by going beyond. So they're, you might call them mundane, worldly, wholesome actions. Abstaining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, speaking truthfully, speaking words that bring unity, harmony, speaking gently and politely, avoiding fruitless talk, thinking good thoughts. Okay, so then when the person passes away, this person is reborn in a non-unafflictive world, that is a world, a pleasant world, a happy world. When he has reappeared in this happy world, unafflictive or pleasant contacts touch him, and being touched by unafflictive contacts, he feels unafflictive feelings, exclusively pleasant, as in the case of the gods of refulgent glory. The gods of refulgent glory, this is a very, very high class of devas or deities. These are the gods who are reborn by attaining and mastering the third dhyana, the third meditative absorption. I think when we come to sutta number 41, we get at the end of that sutta all the classes of deities. So then we will explain it in more detail there. Okay, so in this case too, the Buddha says, thus a being's rebirth or reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed and so on. Thus I say beings are the heirs of their actions. This is called bright action with bright result. Okay, so now we come to the third case. And what puna is dark and bright action with dark and bright results. Okay, the text says, here someone generates a bodily formation that is both afflictive and unafflictive. Similarly, a verbal formation, similarly a mental formation. But the commentary points out, I think this is the point of that note. Yeah, this note just summarizes what the commentary says, that strictly speaking, any given volition with ethical significance has to be either dark or bright. It can't be both. So if a person, say, is swatting a fly, that's a dark action. If he, say, swatting the fly because there's a child sleeping and he doesn't want the fly to land on the baby and bite the baby, then the thought of compassionate concern for the baby, that would be a bright volition, a wholesome volition. So in this case, there will be a mixture. When the person is about to kill the fly, that's unwholesome volition. But the thoughts of caring for the baby, that is a wholesome volition. Or somebody gives in a very generous gift to some charitable organization. He writes a very big check, gives it. At the moment that he's filling out the check and offering it, giving it to the collector or putting it in the post, in the envelope and posting, those will be wholesome volitions. But when he's thinking through this gift and charity, I'll be able to get a deduction on my taxes, or I will be respected in my community, I make a little announcement to my friends that I've given such and such in charity, then maybe they will award me, give me some honorary award as a great philanthropist, then those will be unwholesome thoughts of pride and conceit. And so this is what the commentary says, that in the case of what's called dark and bright action, this is the case of a person whose general quality of their activity in the day-to-day life, throughout their lives, is a mixture of some wholesome activity with a fair balanced amount of unwholesome activity. So this person will reappear in a world that is both afflictive and unafflictive. And when he has reappeared in such a world, then both afflictive and unafflictive contacts touch him. Touched by these mixed contacts, then he feels both afflictive feelings and unafflictive feelings, a mixture of pleasure and pain. And this is characteristic of human experience. and also of some of the devas or gods. These will be gods in the lower heavenly worlds. I think particularly there is a class or several classes of gods which are closely connected with the earth. They're not really dwelling in what we imagine to be a heavenly world, but they're invisible to us unless we have some special faculty of divine eye. So they're invisible to us, but they are in close contact with the earth, with the human realm. I think they dwell, they avoid big cities where there's a congested human population, and a lot of smog and pollution and low moral quality in people's lives. They like wildernesses, forests, remote mountain ranges, lakes, secluded lakes. But these beings are just a few notches above human beings in the great chain of existence. And they also are subject to some pain and suffering. And then there are beings in the lower worlds whose lives are also a mixture of pleasure and pain. I think the commentators take this to be cases of certain beings like asuras, titans. But I think for a good example, we just take pet animals in America, right? Exactly. That's like a king. Well, is it a prince or a princess?
It's a boy.
A boy. An old man, I understand. Well, we will get a chance to see it next week, no? But even more than, unless I'm mistaken, there are people who will spend to buy a bed for their dog much more costly than a whole family in India, say, or China will have for themselves in a lifetime. And the dog every day will get food that you couldn't order in a 3-star hotel. You have to go to 4-star, 5-star hotel. And the dog gets a little bit sick and it's brought to top veterinarian specialists, right? Whereas people in Asia, Africa, will have these crushing, debilitating illnesses their whole lives. And the most primitive medical facilities to treat them. Then when the dog dies, gets a they have animal cemeteries now? Of course. They probably I get a state funeral. Musical instruments, playing the dirge, and maybe hired weepers like in the Chinese funeral. Professional people who are hired to weep and beat their breasts. Okay, so these animals, their lives are a mixture of pleasure and pain. Okay, then we come to the fourth case, which it's explained rather obscurely here. This is called action which is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright result, action that leads to the destruction of action. And what is that? It is the volition for abandoning the kind of action that is dark with dark result. the volition for abandoning the kind of action that is bright with bright result, and the volition for abandoning the kind of action that is dark and bright with dark and bright result. That is called the action that is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright result, action that leads to the destruction of action. And even though this action is said to be not bright, but it's really, that is speaking from a worldly point of view, but this is the action that leads to liberation from the wheel of karma and its fruit. And in another sutta, actually two suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya, the book of fours, I think it's sutta number 235 and 236, this is said to be, in one sutta, the action of the Noble Eightfold Path. In other words, it's right view, right intention, right speech, right livelihood, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And in the next sutta, this is said to be the development of the seven factors of enlightenment. Mindfulness, investigation of phenomena, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And this action, in a way, it's brighter than the ordinary bright action. Because the ordinary bright action, which leads to bright result, that is worldly or mundane, wholesome karma, which will lead to rebirth into a celestial realm, a heavenly realm. But life in that realm is impermanent. Comes to an end, to be followed by new existence someplace else. That new existence determined again by one's accumulation of karma. And so for Buddhism, the aim is not to remain within the realm of birth, the round of birth and death, not even in the heavenly realms, but to gain liberation from the entire conditioned world. And the way that leads to that liberation is the development of the Noble Eightfold Path, or alternatively, the same thing, just a different formula, the development of the seven factors of enlightenment. But this is here the important point, that to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, the seven factors of enlightenment, it needs as a foundation the bright karma with bright result. In other words, for the practice of the higher path to be effective and successful, it has to be grounded upon an ethical way of life, which is achieved by practicing, by observing the 10 pathways of wholesome action. The difference is that a worldly person practices or observes the 10 pathways of wholesome action because they want to achieve, to earn merit, to acquire good karma, that will lead them to a happy heavenly existence. But they don't see the shortcomings, the unsatisfactoriness, even in the heavenly realms of being. But one who sees the impermanence of the heavenly spheres, who sees that there's no final satisfaction, even in the heavenly existence, will then aspire to the unconditioned, to liberation, to the deathless element, Nibbana. And then to gain that liberation, one has to it's not enough just to observe the principles of good behavior, but one has to develop the higher wisdom, the higher true insight into the real nature of things by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, by cultivating the seven factors of enlightenment. And so while still observing the 10 pathways of wholesome action in one's day-to-day life, one builds upon that as one's groundwork, as one's foundation, in order to develop those particular qualities that bring the penetration to the ultimate truth. And so then the Buddha sort of sums up and says, these are the four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. Then when this is said, then Puna, who is observing the ox ascetic practices, expressed his joy, his appreciation to the Buddha. Then this is a stock formula that we come across hundreds of times in the suttas. It says, abhikantang bhante, magnificent venerable sir, magnificent venerable sir, the Blessed One has made the Dharma clear to me in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been upside down. Yeah, turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the darkness for those with eyesight to see forms. Then he says, I go to the Blessed One, to the Buddha for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha. From today, let the Blessed One remember me or consider me a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Oh, I see. The whole formula is on the next page again. Okay, now Puna, with this statement, is now he discards the ascetic practice of an ox. And he becomes, this is a little puzzling to me, he becomes a lay follower of the Buddha. He becomes an upasaka. Even though for a long time he was observing and living an ascetic life as a completely futile and useless type of ascetic life. I don't know why, if he could live that ascetic life for a long time, why doesn't he become a monk? Maybe this is really done just to establish some dramatic situation of a contrast. But his friend Samia, who is following the dog practice, also expresses his appreciation in the same words. He goes for refuge to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then he says, I want to receive the going forth unto the Blessed One. Going forth is pabaja, pravajya, or is it chujya? Chujya? Yeah. Leaving the home life. Yeah. Taking up the homeless life to become an ascetic, first as a, in the later form of the ordination, as a samanera. And then he says, I would receive the full admission. This is the upasampada, the full ordination. I'm not sure that he actually expressed himself in this way. Probably he would have said that I want to become a monk under the Blessed One. But because the compilers of the canon would have in mind the two stages of ordination, so they formulate it this way. But then the Buddha says, and this was a principle that he had laid down for the guidance of the Sangha, that one, you see, if somebody from the household life wants to become a Buddhist monk, he could get the ordination immediately. But if somebody who belonged to another sect, who was an ascetic or renunciant in some other spiritual community, or even some wandering ascetic, wants to become a Buddhist monk, then he wants to become a monk within the Buddha's Dhamma and discipline, then he has to live on probation for 4 months so that the bhikkhus will observe him to see whether he's really suitable to become a Buddhist monk. They did this because there was a certain amount, we have to be quite frank and truthful, intercommunal rivalry and competition in those days. Of course, ascetics and monks depend upon the support of the general population for their livelihood. And so those religious orders which favorably impress the lay people, the householders, would get support from the lay communities, whereas those which make a bad impression would lose that support. So there would have been, once the Buddha became well established as a teacher, ascetics from other creeds would see that the Buddha's order was well supported. So while still convinced of the truth of their own teaching, or their own, the teaching they were formerly following, just for material support, they would join the Buddhist order. And they wouldn't want to observe any of the rules of discipline or to behave in a decent way. And sometimes the other communities, in order to create disharmony between the Buddhist monastic order and the lay community, they would infiltrate the Sangha and then behave in improper ways to create bad impressions so that the Buddhist Sangha would lose its favor. And so the Buddha said that if followers of another creed who had been, you know, living ordained life want to enter the Buddhist order, they have to stay on probation for 4 months. And what the commentary explains, and I think this is probably likely, that they actually get ordained as novices, as samaneras, but they don't get the higher ordination. And so then the bhikkhus, those who have the full ordination, could watch them for the 4 months. And the Buddha said, even in the Vinaya, he says that from time to time, that you should watch how they respond when the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are praised, and when the teaching they were formerly following is happens to be dispraised or criticized. If when the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha is praised, you see that they're getting upset. And if you see when their own teaching is criticized that they're getting upset, then you realize that they still have that loyalty to the other teaching. Of course, sometimes it just takes time for them to overcome that former sense of loyalty to the previous teaching. But after 4 months, then the monks should decide whether they are qualified to receive the full ordination. But the Buddha says, in this sentence here, he says, I recognize individual differences in this matter. That is, the Buddha is able to make exceptions because he can know a person's inner qualities without having to depend on a long observation. So then Sainiya says, again, this is a stock passage which comes over and over again, that if applicants who come from another sect generally have to remain on probation for 4 months and then get ordained, I'm willing to stay on probation for 4 years. Then at the end of the 4 years, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with me, then they can give me the ordination. But the Buddha realized this was not necessary, so he gave Sainiya, he arranged for him to get the ordination immediately. And then it says, not long after his full ordination, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Sainiya, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being. And the Venerable Sainiya became one of the arhats. Okay, and that is the end of the discourse. Any questions, comments? Yes.
This doesn't directly concern the reading, but I don't know where else it would be closer to ask it, you know, in future lectures, and it has to do with rebirth.
Yeah.
Before the Buddhist time, you know, the concept of rebirth was there.
Yeah.
And so when one's reborn, it's like there's a mother essence and father essence, and then the third party.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meet and form the new being.
Yeah.
What is the Buddha's conception of this? How this takes
the Buddha's conception of conception. Yeah. The Buddhist texts say something very, very similar, though it actually comes only in two texts in the Majjhima Nikaya. One is in Sutta number 38. In fact, we could look at it. So I think we'll eventually come to this whole sutra. Sutta 38. It's page 358 in the Middle Length Discourses. Do you see it? Paragraph 26. The descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things. First, there is the union, sexual union, of the mother and father, but the mother is not in season, and the Gandhaba is not present. I'll leave that term for the time being. In this case, no descent of an embryo takes place. Okay, the second possibility, there is the union of mother and father. The mother is fertile in season, but the Gandhaba is not present. In this case, no descent of the embryo takes place. But when there is the union of the mother and father, the mother is in season, and the Gandhaba is present, through the union of these three things, the descent of the embryo takes place. And so the question here is, what is the Gandhaba? And I understand it, the Gandhaba, first, the word Gandhaba in Indian legend, mythology, including Buddhist mythology, in quotation marks, it's a class of beings that are the term normally means a class of beings who function somewhat like celestial musicians. They're the musicians in the worlds of the gods. But they're also said to be Gandhavas, which inhabit groves, trees, orchids. But I don't think the word Gandhaba here is being used in that sense, but rather the word Gandhaba here is being used in the sense of the stream of consciousness of a being that has passed away in some other form of existence and is awaiting the opportunity, the conditions for rebirth, for its rebirth to take place.
Doesn't that sound like the Indian concept of...
Very much so, except that it's not, you see, from the Buddhist point of view, the Brahmins or the Brahmanic schools misinterpreted the Gandhaba by taking it to be a permanent individual self or soul entity. For Buddhism, the Gandhaba is actually an ever-changing being, a being which is ever in the process of becoming just like ourselves. But now that being is in a somewhat disembodied state. It's not connected with the ordinary physical body, but the conditions have not yet appeared in the human realm for it to take rebirth as a human being. And now I found this idea of the Gandhaba corresponds to something which is reported. I've read some cases of people who have memories of their previous life, and not only of the previous life, but they remember their previous death and what took place at death. And these reports coming from different individuals without any possibility of communication are quite consistent. They've been collected by some researchers. This is not hocus pocus, you know, newspaper stand, occult magazines, the mysteries of the beyond, but rigorous scientific investigators who have pursued research in cases of individuals who have report memories of previous lives. And in some of them, they explain what took place at their death. They say remember getting some illness, lying on their deathbed, maybe being treated with medicines. Then, at a certain point, the consciousness seems to have now separated from the body so that they feel almost as though the mind is floated up to the ceiling of the room, and now they're looking down at their body lying on the bed. And they try to get back to the body, but they can't. And there comes some faint recognition at this point that they're dead. Then they might see their relatives come, take the body, prepare the funeral, and they even witness their own funeral. And they might be trying to communicate to their relatives to get back in touch with them, but they're not able to communicate. In one case of the report that I've read, the person trying to communicate with a sister, but the sister paid no attention. But the dog, the family dog by the sister, was barking. This I don't know. But apparently in this case, the dog seemed to have some sense of what the sister couldn't detect. Okay, so then, sometime after the funeral takes place, then the person they find themselves still in a subtle body, which it's like the physical body that they've left, but it's very almost airy or ethereal, very subtle kind of matter, and they move about over great distances very quickly, and they have no very clear idea of how much time is passing. But then at a certain point they will see a woman to whom they feel some connection, some affinity. In the cases I remember, this being or spirit moving about saw a woman. I think she was coming back from shopping with a basket, like a shopping basket. And he lodged himself inside the shopping basket. Sometimes they cling to the woman, and they remain in the vicinity of that woman till the woman has sexual relations with her husband. Then they feel themselves in some way drawn into the woman, and then at that point they lose consciousness, a clear consciousness, until sometime after birth, then they regain a sense of consciousness. And when they reach the age of three, say 2.5, 3, where they start to speak, they have an awareness that they have a sense of their continuity with their previous identity, the identity of the person who was died that they were previously. So they might report that I used to live in such and such a town. My parents had such and such a name. I had so many brothers and sisters. And then I died under such and such conditions. Generally, the ones who have this recollection of continuity are people who had died in childhood or in young adulthood in their previous life. Yeah. I was just going to add that some of these cases have been investigated quite rigorously by there is a professor, now he's retired. He was the chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of Virginia Medical School and also professor of parapsychology, Dr. Ian Stevenson. He had investigated many cases like this in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, India, as well as in countries in which the belief in rebirth is not part of the established religious beliefs. For some reason, in Turkey and Egypt, I think, Islamic countries, found cases like this. And he doesn't jump to like wild conclusions, therefore this proves rebirth is a universal truth. He postulates different, he collects all of the facts of the case, describes them quite meticulously, then he postulates different ways that might be brought forward to explain the facts, and then just the conclusion that he comes to is that of the different explanatory hypotheses that might be offered, the hypothesis that in this case a rebirth has occurred is the simplest, the most economical, and the most convincing. Yeah. Yeah.
Rebirth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems to me those stories tell consciousness is almost permanent, only change in the body.
Yeah.
And that leads to the contribution to how far is one person's consciousness moves on without changing.
Yeah.
And I have trouble with that.
Well, technically, the consciousness is impermanent in that what we call the consciousness is not a lasting entity, but it's a process which is always changing, in that every moment of consciousness arises and passes, arises and passes. But there is a continuity of experience, a preservation of experience, so that within a given life, say this, my life, I can remember what I underwent. I still remember my first day in kindergarten. Even I still remember before I went into kindergarten, my mother telling me the name of who will be the name of my teacher in kindergarten. Okay, that took place when I was 5 years old. I still actually remember even when my mother went into the hospital, or of course I didn't see her go into the hospital, but she took a kind of leave of absence from home to give birth to my sister, 2 years younger than myself, so that would be when I was 3 years old. Okay, so within myself, that consciousness, it's not a permanent entity. There's no self-subsistent entity who is there in 1946 when my sister was born, or 1950, 49 when I went to kindergarten. I don't even know what year it was. But the memory is preserved in that there's a continuity of experience, that each moment of experience, of consciousness arising and passing, in some way the potentiality of recalling previous experience is transmitted. And then there's also a preservation and transmission of, say, character traits, character dispositions. So, say, the person that I am now the character, I hope has changed a little bit since those. But at least there's some continuity in that will go on from life to life, so that somebody who develops these special higher faculties can recollect consciously, deliberately experiences in previous lives. But the consciousness, the mind itself, is always changing. There's no entity that's preserved. But there is that continuity, so it preserves a kind of relative identity. Did you want to say something? And then there are some cases that are quite remarkable. I've come across, well, one myself. This was in Sri Lanka. There was a young boy in Kandy, the town where I was living. From the age of 3, he started reciting Pali suttas, which he could not have heard from any monk. Whole suttas. He would tell the person that wound up adopting him. He was from a family without a father and died or left. He was living with a poor mother. Then a well-to-do childless couple in Kandy were actually living close by him. They heard about this case and they sort of adopted the boy, his mother and sister, and brought them up. This boy, and the way they heard about the boy or came to adopt the boy was by hearing reports from his mother, who I think worked as a servant for that couple originally, that he was reciting sutras at the age of 3, long suttas. And then by the age of, I think he started with the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra, the first discourse of the Buddha. By the age of 7, he was reciting the great discourse on causation, Mahanidana Sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta on the foundations of mindfulness. His adopting father recorded these suttas, his recitations. He didn't have the recollection all the time. It wasn't available to him at will. But most of the time he would be like an ordinary boy. But then suddenly there would come these times when he would say, I'm starting to remember, I'm starting to remember. Then his adoptive father, they would get the tape recorder. Then he would sit down. He doesn't go into a hypnotic trance, but he just sort of becomes concentrated and absorbed. Then he starts reciting the suttas. And I've heard the recordings of them. And I have to say, the quality of his pronunciation of Pali is just so precise and so pure that no monks, contemporary monks that I've heard, could recite Pali.
What was the nationality of this boy?
Oh, so he was Sri Lankan, Sinhalese. Oh. Sinhalese boy. Yeah, I know him quite well. Yeah. I met him actually in September here. And
So it wasn't unnatural for him to know Pali.
Well, you see, he then would explain how he came to have this memories. He said that there was a great Buddhist commentator in the 5th century, Acharya Buddhaghosa, who wrote the Visuddhimagga and other commentaries. And he said that he was an assistant of Buddhaghosa. And so he had learned these suttas, apparently, in that lifetime. And he was reciting in the style of the chanting of the 5th century A.C. Yeah.
That means the number of whole beings.
Yeah.
From the beginning of
yeah.
The sentence, never change. It just changes from different kind of reward of
beings. Yeah.
That seems to me to be like that.
Yeah.
Then the number of beings.
Yeah.
Some become to plants or some become.
No, they actually consciousness doesn't become plants. Yeah. Well, anyway, this is dealing with the mathematics of infinity, so it's a question, I think.
I mean, there's the continuity.
Yeah. Well, those beings who get liberated, then their consciousness no longer moves within the cycle of rebirth. But this gets, you get into all sorts of problems that come when you deal with the mathematics of infinities. Since if you have beginningless time, then an infinite number of beings has attained liberation over during infinite time, and yet there's still an infinite number of beings. So, okay, any further questions? It's getting late, so we have to stop. Next time is Sutta, I think it's Chulakama Vibhanga Sutta,
135,
number 135. Okay, we transfer the merits. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Panyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga